全国翻译专业资格水平考试辅导丛书，英语口译综合能力三级，第五核。
Part 3, Passage 1. Nowadays, the operations of our businesses, governments, and financial institutions are more and more controlled by information that exists only inside computer memories.Anyone clever enough to modify this information for his purpose can get surprising rewards. Even worse, a number of people who have done this and been caught at it have managed to get away without punishment. It is easy for computer crimes to go undetected if no one checks up on what the computer is doing. But even if the crime is detected, the criminal may walk away not only unpunished,but with a growing recommendation from his former employers. Of course, we have no statistics on crime that go undetected, but it is sad to note how many crimes we do know about that were detected by accident, not by systematic inspections or other security procedures. The computer criminals who have been caught may have been the victims of uncommonly bad luck. For example,A certain key punch operator complained of having to stay overtime to punch extra cards. Investigation showed that the extra cards she was asked to punch were for dishonest purposes. Unlike other criminals who must leave the country, commit suicide, or go to prison, computer criminals sometimes escape punishment, demanding not only that they not be charged,but that they be given good recommendations and perhaps other benefits. All too often, their demands have been met. Why? Because company executives are afraid of the bad reputation that would result if the public found out that their computer had been misused. They hesitate at the thought of a criminal telling the public how he stole the most confidential records right under the noses of the company's executives.Accountants and security staff. And so another computer criminal walks away with just the recommendations he needs to continue his crimes elsewhere.
Passage 2. In 1996, there were 200 million handguns in the U.S., and a total of 9,390 Americans in a population of about 260 million people.Were murdered with handguns. If the 27.5 million Canadians who have tough laws on handgun ownerships shot each other up in the same way as the U.S., they would have suffered the loss of about 990 souls. In reality, handguns were used to kill only 106 Canadians that year. What accounts for this difference? Do Canadians perhaps prefer other instruments of murder?Apparently not. Canadian murder rates overall are much lower than the American ones. Are the Canadians then a race of angels? Not likely. In cultural terms, the average inhabitant of metropolitan Vancouver is about the same as the average inhabitant of Seattle. Canada also has the same violent films, TV programs, and video games as the U.S. does.Let's compare the Americans with another closely related nation, one that today suffers from strong social tension, Germany. Here is a society with a high rate of long-term unemployment, a large body of working-class immigrants, and plenty of political extremists. In Germany, it is hard to get a handgun, but the American opponents of handgun control tell us,that bad eggs eager to get guns will always find ways around the law. So there's no point in passing laws to restrict ownership of these weapons. Is there? Well, it would seem there is. In 1996, Germany, with its 80 million inhabitants, had 211 handgun murders, and, again, a vastly lower overall murder rate than in the U.S.If the Germans had blown the objects of their displeasure away at the American rate, they would have killed 2,900 people. So it goes. Compare America with any nation similar to it culturally and economically, and the result is always the same. Americans own many more handguns, and vastly more murders are committed with the guns, even though Americans are, by and large, just as law-abiding as their European, Australian, or North American cousins.
Passage 3. Many crimes in America are committed by people using guns. Most of these people have a record of criminal offenses. By law, these criminals are not allowed to purchase or own guns. Do they care? No. They do not obey laws and find other ways to get guns. The problem is a people problem, not a gun problem. In America, the whole nation has become one that has largely rejected the traditional rules and ethics of Western society that have helped it become a society of progress and the rule of law. Modern society has moved to a very self-centered concept of, I am my own law. There is no more black and white or absolute right or wrong. No higher law determines it. We decide individually. What seems right and feels right for me is therefore right. This concept is called moral relativism. Depending upon circumstances and how we feel about an action, it becomes right or wrong for us. For at least the last generation, public education in America has largely failed to teach right and wrong. Public schools can only appeal to personal feelings and opinions. The young people lack moral convictions. Families are being broken up. Children and parents often operate in different worlds. It seems that the parents of the two murderers did not know something was wrong with their sons and did not know what they were really like or what their interests were. Some cultural influences of today must also share in responsibility for such murders. Many video and computer games are filled with mass destruction. You are the warrior and must destroy as many enemies as possible. The more you kill, the higher you score. To get back to our original question, gun control or people, can it be done? People control will not be accomplished until the heart of America changes. Government cannot accomplish this. Gun control will probably be increased. Government can accomplish this. Will it stop the violence? Probably not. There are too many ways to commit violence. Part 4. There is an undeniable link between acts of terror and illicit drugs. Law enforcement officials around the world have long recognized this close connection. But a changing world and recent events have made this link more relevant in the daily lives of all Americans. The bottom line is simple. Terror and drug groups are linked in a mutually beneficial relationship by money, tactics, geography, and politics. Americans must understand that our individual choices about illicit drug use have the power to support or undermine our nation's war on terrorism. Drugs form an important part of the financial infrastructure of terror networks. 12 of the 28 terror organizations identified by the U.S. Department of State in October 2001 traffic in drugs. Drug income is the primary source of revenue for many of the more powerful international terrorist groups. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, receives about $300 million from drug sales annually. The United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, AUC, relies on the illegal drug trade for 40 to 70% of its income. Peru's Shining Path is more dependent on drug money than ever before, and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, which provided safe haven to Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network, used revenues from opium and heroin to stay in power. In 2000, Afghanistan was responsible for more than 70% of the world's opium trade, resulting in significant income to the Taliban. Drug traffickers and terrorists use similar methods to achieve their criminal ends. Most importantly, they share a common disregard for human life. Many drug trafficking organizations engage in acts that most people would consider terrorist in nature. These include gruesome public killing of innocents, large-scale bombings intended to intimidate government, kidnapping, and torture. These organizations prey on young people both to grow their ranks and to keep their illegitimate businesses operating. Money laundering, arms for drugs exchanges, and use of phony documents are common among terrorist and drug groups. Drug traffickers and terrorist organizations both attack the underpinnings of legitimate government institutions to achieve their objectives, or enjoy the protection of governments that condone terror or drug trafficking. Drug traffickers and terror groups are both drawn to regions where central government authority is weak. If a terror group already controls a region and has excluded or neutralized legitimate government institutions, drug production only requires a business deal. The growing link between terrorists and the drug trade contributes to an increased threat to America. Drug and terrorist organizations are taking advantage of the global economy to expand the scope, scale, and reach of their activities, and, as a result, their ability to harm American citizens and to damage U.S. interests is dramatically expanding. As state sponsors for their activities become scarce, terrorists are increasingly dependent on drug financing. The combined force of their alliance poses an enhanced threat to regional stability, American national security, and the future of our country's youth. Parents, educators, faith, and community leaders recognize that youth drug use is a serious issue in this country, and they work tirelessly to educate children about the dangers of substance abuse. Today, there is a new reason to continue this important effort. The illegal drug trade is linked to the support of terror groups across the globe. Buying and using illegal drugs is not a victimless crime. It has negative consequences that can touch the lives of people around the world. September 11th has brought the complex and horrific reality of terrorism into the lives of all Americans. Many are asking, how did this happen, and what can I do? The link between terror and drugs is an important part of the puzzle, as is the recognition that individual decisions about using drugs have real-world consequences. Unit 9, B.
Part 1, A. By 1900, the worries the Victorians had about the uneducated masses in the cities and about crime had dwindled. There was universal education and better housing. The police were an accepted part of British life, and the crime rate was lower. British governments in the first two-thirds of the 20th century felt able to carry out new policies regarding the handling of criminals that emphasized reform rather than punishment. Young offenders were removed entirely from the adult justice system. Efforts were made to keep them out of custody through probation in 1907. Borstal schools were started in 1902 with the aim of turning young offenders into better citizens. The same aims were applied to adult prisons. Punitive rules were relaxed so that prisoners could lead more normal lives. In an attempt to deal with unemployment and family breakdown, which often led ex-prisoners back to crime, they were given meaningful work, with pay, and family visits were made easier. Even more controversially, capital punishment was abolished in 1965. However, times changed in the last decades of the century. Crime was increasing. There was less sympathy with trying to reform offenders, more sympathy for the victims of crime, and more desire to punish. From 1972, offenders could be given community service orders. This meant doing many hours of socially worthwhile work to show that the offender was repaying a debt to society. In the 1990s, tagging, or attaching an electronic tag to criminals, was introduced for offenders as a way of keeping them out of trouble. In some areas, offenders have been brought face to face with their victims in an effort to help both get over the crime and move on.
B. 1. It is generally agreed that bribery in various forms is on the increase in many countries. 2. The International Chamber of Commerce favors a code of conduct that would ban the giving and seeking of bribes. 3. The suspect was accused of withholding some important evidence from the court. 4. They believed that the wanted man had gone into hiding. 5. The employees think nothing of their corrupt manager. 6. A writer recently argued that industry is caught in a web of bribery and that everyone is on the take. 7. Because of confusion, hearing, and visual difficulties, old people are prime victims of dishonest door-to-door salesmen. 8. We all condemn cruelty to children. 9. An honest person never takes to stealing even when he falls into financial difficulties. 10. The foresters heard a terrifying roar that made their blood freeze.
Part 2. Crime in the United States accounts for more death, injuries, and loss of property than all natural disasters combined. The Disaster Center is pleased to be able to provide you with access to the statistics of crime compiled by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. When you experience a crime, it can make you respond in ways that you might not understand. In that crisis situation, you may react in ways that conflict with the assumptions you have created about yourself. At the time of the crime, you may feel a sense of helplessness, fear, and anger. Afterward, you may have a hard time relating the experience to the context of your assumptions of your life. A conflict often develops between your idea of the world before the crime and your idea of the world after the disaster. On top of this, the victims and their relatives often experience financial problems, and time is often lost from work to handle the legal, insurance, and personal problems associated with being a victim. The trauma associated with any crime often makes it hard for victims to cope with normal daily routines, and the victims of crime are frequently blamed by their friends for not being more careful. The trauma continues as victims of crime often find themselves ignored by law enforcement and confused by the court system.
Part 3, Passage 1. The violent criminal seems to have become a kind of hero in our time in Britain and a number of other countries. He is seen on the screen. He is pursued by the press and paid vast sums of money for his life stories. Newspapers that specialize in crime reporting sell extremely well, and the publishers of police and robber stories or murder mysteries have never had it so good. When you read about the achievements of the great train robbers, it makes you wonder whether you are reading about some glorious resistance movement. The criminal is looked on as a hero by the masses. It is no wonder he is a privileged person who expects and receives VIP treatment wherever he goes. Capital punishment used to be a major factor preventing crime. It made the violent robber think twice before using his gun. It prevented unarmed policemen from being killed while pursuing their duty by killers armed with automatic weapons. Above all, it protected the most vulnerable members of society, young children, from brutal violence. It is horrifying to think that the criminal can literally get away with murder. We all know that life sentence does not mean what it says. After 10 years or so of good conduct, the most desperate killer is free to return to society, where he will live very comfortably on the incomes he had obtained from his crime, or he will go on committing crimes until he is caught again. People are always willing to hold liberal views at the expense of others. It is always fashionable to act as the defender of the weak, so long as you remain unaffected. Did the defenders of crime, one wonders, in their desire for fair play, consult the victims before they suspended capital punishment? Hardly. You see, they couldn't, because all the victims were dead.
Passage 2. Since the Second World War, the prison population has increased enormously in Britain, from 20,000 in 1950 to 60,000 in the 1990s. By the 1980s, overcrowding had become a serious problem and led to violent protests such as at Strangeways in Manchester in 1990. The government responded by building more prisons, reintroducing prison ships, and by letting security firms run private prisons. Then comes the question, do prisons work? Of course, they keep dangerous criminals off the street, and the deprivation of freedom represents a very real punishment. However, it is doubtful that they reform prisoners or prevent crimes. In any case, it is probably impossible to realize all these different aims. Most prisoners commit crimes again, and most prisons are crime schools, where new inmates learn new tricks and become drug takers. Prisons are also hugely expensive, which is why some alternative forms of punishment have been tried. In 1907, probation was introduced. By this system, the offender was not sent to prison. He or she simply had to report to the police on a weekly basis and met with a probation officer. This measure, together with longer time to pay fines, succeeded in reducing the prison population between 1910 and 1930. Capital punishment remained an alternative to prison until 1965. In 1967, parole and suspended sentences were introduced. The former was a reduction in sentence for good behavior. The latter meant that the offender did not go to jail and his or her sentence was called off if he or she did not commit crime again. In 1972, community service was introduced. Criminals were sentenced to so many hours of work in the community, and more recently, electronic tagging has been tried. This is really just a more technologically advanced form of probation.
Passage 3. Juvenile crime was and is still a serious problem facing British society. A lot of factors contribute to this. To begin with, family values have broken down. There is bad parenting or the breakdown of the family. Then, a more liberal atmosphere at school reinforces the absence of discipline and values experienced at home. Pupils are not taught to concentrate or work properly. Poverty and unemployment can be another factor. Unemployed teenagers are poor, are bored, and have time on their hands. Crime seems to be one of their few alternatives. In addition, television and the cinema make robbery and violence seem part of everyday life. The advertising industry promotes a lifestyle that values money and possessions. Crime can be a shortcut to this lifestyle, an easy way of making money. Finally, a great deal of theft and burglary and violent crime is drug-related, and a lot of other violence is caused by large quantities of alcohol. In the past, young criminals used to be sent to adult prisons. In 1880, there were 6,500 children under 16 in adult prisons, 900 under 12. By the turn of the century, it was becoming accepted that children should be treated differently from adults. In 1908, the Children's Charter came into force. The charter stopped children under 14 being sent to prison, and it created juvenile courts. There are now a wide variety of punishment options open to the juvenile court, such as putting a child into care. Other sentences include fining the parents, Saturday attendance at an attendance center for 17 to 21-year-olds up to 36 hours, and up to 120-hour community service for 16 to 18-year-olds. There are also detention centers meant to give 14 to 21-year-olds a military-style short, sharp shock for 3 to 16 weeks, and youth custody where young offenders serve longer sentences of 4 to 12 months. Part 4. In recent years, drug crime has decreased, both in the number of cases and as a percentage of prosecutions. While in 1996, drug cases accounted for more than 65% of the office's 9,862 defendants, in 2002, this percentage decreased to 51%. Nevertheless, drug crime is still a very serious problem in this district. The District Attorney's Narcotics Bureau prosecutes serious offenses relating to the possession and sale of controlled substances, including heroin, cocaine, and crack. In addition to these established drugs, ecstasy and other designer drugs are available on the streets of the district. The Bureau prosecutes individuals who sell these drugs with the same vigor as those who sell any other controlled substance. The Bureau's senior assistant district attorneys also prosecute homicides and other violent crimes, most of which are drug-related. The district attorney employs a number of strategies to reduce drug crime in the area. A combination of vigorous prosecution of defendants who have been accused of drug crimes, civil enforcement remedies, and allowing appropriate defendants to enter drug treatment as an alternative to incarceration helps to ensure that justice is done. As in other parts of the city and nation, drug crime constitutes a persistent problem here. Through careful screening of defendants' criminal history and drug use, the office seeks to identify defendants who might benefit from drug treatment and become assets to their community. The state law provides enhanced penalties for those who sell drugs within 1,000 feet of school grounds, and the district attorney continues to focus special attention on these cases. In 2002, Narcotics Bureau staff screened 1,607 school drug arrests for presentation to a grand jury for indictment. Of these, 294 defendants agreed to be prosecuted by Superior Court information instead of indictment. Another 682 were indicted by a grand jury. Since 1993, the district attorney has offered certain substance-abusing defendants who have been charged with narcotics offenses the opportunity to enter an alternative to imprisonment drug treatment program. The first population to be offered this option in this district was 16 to 19-year-olds, first very serious drug abusers. However, over the years, the option has been offered to older offenders and those with a prior non-violent conviction. While the treatment options and alternative dispositions and sentences vary with the defendant's age and prior record, the process is similar for all defendants considered for drug treatment as an alternative. Each candidate for diversion undergoes a thorough screening and evaluation to determine whether he or she is eligible for a drug treatment program. Factors considered in the evaluation include the defendant's age, criminal record, history of substance abuse, and suitability for rehabilitation. Although not all drug abusers are successful in treatment, for some, the opportunity to enter drug treatment makes the difference between a life lost to drugs and illegal activity and a productive life and job. The individual's substance abuse history, age, and other factors determine the type of treatment and its duration. His or her criminal history affects the case outcome following either successful completion of treatment or failure to complete treatment, resulting in a prison sentence. A total of 847 defendants entered drug treatment as an alternative to imprisonment in 2002, and about 7,300 defendants have been placed in drug treatment programs since 1993. Unit 10, A.
Part 1. A. As a volunteer teacher here in China, I often hear this from my students. My English is so poor, how can I improve it? One of my standard answers is to speak English all the time, whatever you are doing, wherever you are, whether alone or with others, since listening and speaking is the natural way to learn a language. The other answer, equally important, is to relax and have fun with the language. Because obsessive study will, in the long run, damage not only your health, but also your present and future social life, and may indeed dull your mind rather than sharpen it. As an example, I could mention a student I know at Hubei University. During her first year, against advice, she studied 7 days a week, leaving no time to get to know even her own classmates, let alone find friends or get involved in leisure activities. As exam time approached, she became increasingly fixated on her books. Gripped by anxiety, she failed to widen her approach to finding answers to problems of translation or composition. Intellectual exercises where there are seldom simple, straightforward answers that can be learnt by heart. In the end, she missed the passing mark by 2 points, and she must have been deeply perplexed. Such diligence, yet what could she show for it? I am convinced that if she had taken time out to relax and chat, in English, with her fellow students, read more widely, and talked her problems over with others, she would have been under much less stress, developed better learning techniques, and finally passed that exam without a hitch.
B. 1. The language a child learns is not genetically inherited, but is acquired in a particular language-using environment. 2. The most fundamental change in the area of second language learning in recent years has been a shift from concern with the teacher, the textbook, and the method to an interest in the learner and the acquisition process. 3. An error in learning a foreign language is not something which hinders a student's progress, but is probably a clue to the active learning progress being made by a student as he or she tries out ways of communicating in the new language. 4. Motivation to learn the language may be as much a result of success as a cause. 5. Many languages manage without quite basic grammatical or lexical features, while others burden themselves with remarkable complexities. 6. A vital adjunct to language is the gesture, which in some cultures can almost constitute a vocabulary all its own. 7. The complexities of the English language are such that even native speakers cannot always communicate effectively, as almost every American learns on his first day in Britain. 8. In the course of the week, virtually all language and reading skills are reinforced in a variety of contexts and with a variety of materials. 9. The teacher is a facilitator during the short passage readings, intervening only in the event that linguistic expertise is needed to keep the discussion going. 10. Throughout the semester, students are taught to shift gears, to vary their reading strategies according to their goals for the selection at hand.
Part 2. Many language learners absorb only what they are taught in class about the language. If the teacher or their textbook hasn't yet covered that point, they shut their minds to it. The good language learner is constantly analyzing, categorizing, and synthesizing their new language. They know that learning a new language is a very complex matter, like putting together the pieces of a huge jigsaw puzzle. They absorb what they are taught in class, but they are also actively involved in discovering where new pieces fit into the overall picture. And so, they are constantly trying to find schemes for classifying the information they have gathered. They also note how other people learnt the language, trying out their methods to see if they are suitable for them. The poor language learner often lacks a planned and systematic approach to acquiring the language, and hence fails to reach a reasonable standard of performance. The good language learner, however, recognizing the magnitude of the task, sets down a plan of campaign, dividing their study program into attainable goals, and organizing regular times for study. Then, they systematically record what they learn about the language, whether pronunciation, grammar, or vocabulary, so that it is readily available for reference. The poor language learner, upon discovering that the way they were taught to learn the language has proven ineffective, complains and gives up.
Part 3, Passage 1. Jack had all the potential for not getting English. Lacking in language learning aptitude, somewhat conservative and rather shy, he preferred tasks which used his hands rather than his head. He could easily have given up when, after a few weeks of language study, he realized just how slowly he was progressing. And yet, he made it. In fact, he got English well. Why? First and foremost, he had a good attitude. Although he's not the bookish type and doesn't really enjoy the classroom, yet he knew that he had to work hard at his studies. In fact, harder than the average language student if he was going to get anywhere in the language. And he did. Secondly, he was willing to face up to his weak areas and do something about them. So when he found that memorizing vocabulary didn't come easily to him, he redoubled his efforts by using flashcards and forced himself to review at regular intervals those words that didn't stick easily. Also, recognizing his somewhat shy personality, yet at the same time knowing that fluency only comes through much practice, he was willing to spend 20 minutes after language school each day talking with someone who understood his level and who therefore kept the conversation simple. When he found a person with whom he really related well, he would spend much time with them talking on many and varied issues. Jack had the advantage that he had learnt another foreign language before coming to America. That one hadn't been easy for him either, yet eventually he got it to a good level. This proved to be of real help when learning English because it enabled him to recognize his learning curve, and most important, that whereas learning that language had been an uphill struggle, he did eventually make it, thus giving him hope for learning English.